sights to show you.
Welcome to the 43rd episode of the Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I'm your host, Sierra Houck, and this week's a little weird because we don't have Melissa with us, but I have Jackie as normal.
Hello.
And then I have a very special guest, my own father, Jason Houck.
Hello. Thank you for welcoming me on the show.
Yeah, so this episode we're going to talk about like local legends and weird stuff that happens in your hometown and things like that. And I realized a lot of my stories, I'm not entirely sure if they're factual or if they're just stuff that my dad made up to keep me busy as a kid.
We will find out tonight.
Yeah, so I have my dad on as a source of stories and also as a little fact checker. Okay.
Mr. Houck, we've heard a lot of awesome things about you, so it's awesome that you can come on and talk with us here.
Thank you. Oh, it's just awesome to be on. This is great. The internet.
Before we do that, Jackie has one recommendation that I'm super curious about why she wants to talk about it.
Okay, so yeah, this is super weird. You know, when I was thinking about recommendations for this episode, I actually have been going back and watching a lot of movies that you and Melissa have been recommending over the past, God, we've been doing this almost 2 years. So I was gonna talk about some of those, and I found some recent horror artists. I was gonna talk about those, and those all seem tame and fun. But then today I found out about some kind of real life feminist horror that I can't move past it. I can't stop thinking about it. So this is it's a stretch to call it horror, but it is horror in terms that us women have to deal with this kind of nonsense. Apparently, back in 2010, Honda made a version of their Fit car called the Honda Fit She, and it was baby pink. It had it had pink stitching on the interior. It had extremely simplified controls inside. It had a pop-up closet in the trunk. Oh. It had a place for your purse. And you know how in cars the passenger side seat has that cosmetic mirror on the visor? This had it on both sides, and it was bigger and very well lit. The windshield was even larger and had better UV protection so that, you know, we don't get them wrinkles. Like,
oh, yeah, of course. That's a big concern I have with the car.
They stopped making this, but it took them until 2014 to stop making this abomination of a car. Weird. Here. And it's just one of those real life horrors that we just have to face every day. And I'm very upset that this existed at all.
When are marketers going to realize that just putting something for women on it doesn't make it like a better or good product?
I know. Like that whole Bic pens for women fiasco. Like, mm-hmm. Ooh, I hope someone got fired over that.
Yeah, that's awful. Do you know if these were released in the U.S.? I'm trying to think if I've ever seen something that might
they
have been.
They weren't.
I don't think so.
They were mostly released in Asia.
Oh, okay.
Sounds like a Barbie product.
I know, right?
Yeah. Well, my recommendation is very much related to the topic, so it'll be a good transition. I want to talk about this docuseries that was recently put on Netflix called Wild Wild Country, and it's a 6-part series about a cult that popped up in Oregon, and it's about the backstory of how it was formed over in Asia and why they came over to the US, and then what happened when this supposedly very loving and everybody is equal kind of cult shows up in rural Oregon around all the like racist redneck neighbors.
Interesting.
And what happens from there. And this happened in the 80s, right, Dad?
That's right. And I've only seen the first part of this documentary, and it's so far it sounds like they've got a great idea, so I hope it works out okay.
I know,
so it is based on a real something that really happened.
Yeah.
Oh goodness.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so this cult leader Rajneesh had this kind of, trying to think of what the category would be, even because it's
definitely
not based on giving up all of your possessions or anything like that. It's very like works pretty well with capitalism kind of thing. It's very, like, support yourself and move forward, and it's led by this woman who's like his protege, who is very brassy and like doesn't care what anybody thinks of her, and she's gonna like be as powerful as she wants to be, kind of thing.
Sheila, yeah.
Yeah. And at first it sounds pretty great. Like they're gonna work on the land and like just do everything very like eco-friendly and use solar and all this kind of stuff. But then once they petition to make themselves their own city and they make their own militia, things kind of start to go downhill.
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
Well, I'll tell you, I grew up in the 80s and I remember this happening in real time. And although I was only, you know, 12, 13 years old, it certainly was very big news at the time. And I do remember one being intrigued by the idea of this New Age philosophy coming to Oregon, the idea of, you know, a commune for people. And certainly I remember that with every bit of news, every bit of discussion about this project was always as these are the others. And certainly in the media, they were always, you know, shown as being outsiders, being, you know, different. They,
To be fair, they did dress in all red.
That's right.
So they stood out as different.
It
was a little menacing.
It was kind of exciting at the time because, you know, the idea of, I always thought that this commune would be around like by the time I was old enough to go travel and I just wanted to go check them out. Like we had the followers would come to Bend on occasion because St. Charles Medical Center was the largest hospital. They would come there occasionally. And it would be like, they would dress in red. And I don't know what we would expect them to do. Other than that, they kind of acted like normal people. But they certainly were certainly like the others, the something to be studied or be maybe afraid of.
Sounds a little scary. Yeah. Well, it definitely becomes scary because eventually, not to spoil anything,
right?
But eventually they wind up poisoning everybody.
Yes,
in the surrounding area.
Was,
right?
That was a big deal. Yeah, the attempt, the poisoning of the local salad bars and different elected officials.
What?
The attempt to
I know it gets really out of control.
I hope I'm not spoiling. Yeah, it was it was a big deal at the time, and certainly sparked our interest, our imagination.
So this happened where you grew up while you were coming of age there.
Yes. Well, we're in Central Oregon and Antelope is, you know, maybe like a couple hours drive north, but honestly, it might as well have been a million miles away for, you know, a 12-year-old kid who knows his little world. It was something.
Yeah. Antelope only had like 40 people living there too. It was like the smallest town. And they bought like this huge ranch for their commune, and it was right neighboring against big swatch of land who was owned by the guy who started Nike, who's like this very like big wig corporate kind of guy. And so when these guys moved in next door, he was definitely not gonna let that happen. And so they were right from the beginning going up against really like powerful political people, and these cult leaders were like, we will play that game for sure. And so they started bringing people in so that they could get more votes on like the local councils and things like that. And they, within like the breadth of this documentary, they grow super quickly, and as they're growing, it really gets out of hand super fast too. Which, I mean, I guess in reality it was over a couple of years.
It seemed to happen pretty quick,
In the documentary, it ramps up a lot, yeah. But yeah, that's on Netflix. And I've been seeing lots of people talking about it online. Maybe that's just my corner of the internet. But I'm excited that people are hearing about it. Because I had only heard, like, oh, there was this Oregon cult that my dad knew about. And they poisoned all these people. And that's like,
yeah, that needs much more news. Like,
what the hell? I know. It's wild. It was like the biggest bioterrorism.
I think the really shocking thing, of course, was the fact that, you know, they were bringing in, you know, homeless people, the offering drugs, sex, allowing them to drop out, and that was pretty salacious at the time. And watching the documentary, it turns out, I guess, all of the rumors were pretty true too about some of the debauchery and abuse of the followers that was going on. Yeah, it's a lot to take in.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. But the documentary is really well put together, and it has interviews with the people who are in the cult now, looking back on it and being like, "Oh, they blew it out of proportion. We were just trying to be, you know, like hitting people.
Oh,
and, like,
God, no.
Preach love and companionship." Right. Yeah, it's wild.
And being able to get that interview with Sheila, who was really the embodiment the of evil, the face of all that was wrong. And hearing her story has been amazing.
Mm-hmm. She went on a ton of talk shows at the time in the 80s and like was known for having this like real potty mouth and like she has to get her one expletive in kind of thing to like be very sensational and like keep it kind of in the front of the news. And she was all about going on and getting publicity for the thing, like not trying to cover it up or anything. She was very vocal. So there's a ton of good footage.
Have I never heard anything about this before? This is bananas.
I know. Yeah. And I think the Duplass brothers produced the documentary. And of course they always have like kind of weird twinge to the stories they tell. So it's very fitting.
The Bhagwan, he had like 30 Rolls Royces and, you know, that's what I remember. He had all these Rolls Royces. How many do you need?
All of them. All of them.
Right.
It's funny.
Exactly.
And this was happening in Central Oregon, where there's a ton of other stuff. The one thing that I want to talk about as like a local kind of weird attraction thing that I love going to is called Peterson Rock Garden, which isn't too spooky or scary, but it's a kind of a park where this guy built a ton of structures out of rocks and things. And so there's like miniature bridges and castles and things off across this like huge park. There's all these like crazy structures and lots of gemstones and things like that. In the like kind of outside of Bend, kind of in the middle of nowhere where you wouldn't expect it to be.
Yeah, between Bend and Redmond.
Mm-hmm.
And then you
and they have a bunch of peacocks there. It's great.
yeah. That I think they originally began that construction in the 1900s. The owner kept adding new additions, and you know, he created a Statue of Liberty made out of granite, little stones. And by the time he passed away in 1952, it was a huge, I think, like a 4-acre site, including the museum and all of these little creations he made.
There's something extremely similar in Miami called Coral Castle that was built in the early 1900s. I grew up in Miami and we went there when I was a kid, but it's literally a castle, like a big castle made out of coral rock, which coral rock is incredibly heavy. And he did this in the early 1900s, supposedly to get the attention of a girl, which he never did. Can't remember his name, but it was one guy who, you know, he didn't have modern equipment to drag this coral rock over to the site and build this stuff, but somehow he managed, mostly by himself, to make this castle over there. And it's pretty crazy. Like there are like actual doors that weigh a ton, like an actual ton, that just swing open with no effort at all. And like the way it's balanced there is it's crazy. There are accurate sundials going on there.
Oh, neat. Yeah. That's awesome.
It's pretty insane.
It's kind of like a Winchester house kind of thing, that like obsession of not stopping, just building and building and building on.
Yeah. I kind of wish I had that drive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have a whole legacy from it. Also in Oregon, while we're on the topic of kind of like roadside attraction places and like weird buildings, there's the Oregon Vortex, which if you've seen Gravity Falls, is pretty much exactly like the episode where they go to all the roadside attractions and things like that. So Oregon is absolutely just as spooky and weird and like bizarre as you'd want it to be from
Oregon
watching that show.
Oregon sounds amazing.
It's pretty good. I don't know if I've actually been to the Oregon Vortex. I've seen lots of pictures of people standing like all like optical illusion kind of thing. So like one side of the room is really small and then one is really big, but they're all level and like in proportion, like it's all messed up. Dad, have you been there before?
I have not been to the roadside attraction Oregon Vortex, but I can speak to the fact that Oregon is known for for its vortexes and beyond this one site. A lot of, you know, odd places, ley lines that cross. We actually have a group here that study a science. They call it chelonic science, where they find these ley lines, and then they travel in groups to these places, and through the power of prayer, realign the universe, the planet, back the way it should be. It's interesting to note, though, that the ley lines always seem to appear near places that are great tourist attractions, so that they can also
work their
summer tour of Scotland, and also, you know, do this ley line work. And it's very amazing stuff.
Interesting. I should mention, for a long time, you and I were both volunteering at the Metaphysical Library in Ashland.
You did what now?
It actually is back now, too. It just reopened it. Yes.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. It's just, I mean, it's a library of, like, books about ley lines and that kind of thing, and psychic readings and ghosts and cryptids and the Book of the Dead and that kind of thing. Yeah, like, it runs the breadth of a very hippy-dippy kind of, you know, things about, like, different dimensions and vibrations and things like that, and chakras and that kind of getting into the, like, spiritual kind of side of it, but then also getting into, like, this kind of stuff, like local legends and
urban
legends.
It is a hot spot for the paranormal activity and UFO activity of our community, and more than just a place for a sharing of resources, is a sharing of community. And if there are aliens that walk among us, they participate in the Metaphysical Library. Yes,
they probably hang out there. I remember when it first opened, there was, like, this big grand opening party thing, and so everybody was, like, milling about, and there was, like, artwork and stuff around. Then all of a sudden, like, all the lights went crazy and, like, were flashing, and all these, like, men in black were coming through with, like, flashlights and briefcases and things. It's like, X-Files theme starts playing. Like, it was crazy. Nice. It was great. Jackie, you want to take one?
Sure.
Just kind of flip-flop back and forth?
Let's see, what do we want to start with here?
Yeah, so we have both coasts kind of covered as far as, like, the creepy ghosts of Savannah, and then the aliens and cryptids and things of Oregon.
Yeah, we compiled some legends in places we've lived. Sierra, you also have some Seattle stuff going on there too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a few things from Asheville. To start it off, a little slow here, there's something called the Dotson Runway Graves here in Savannah. And Savannah is often hailed as the most haunted city in America. I mean, there's no way to measure that. I don't know how they come up with that. But there's certainly a lot of culture surrounding the ghosts in Savannah. Like, you cannot walk a block downtown without running into three different ghost tours. It's crazy. But it's a lot of fun, and it really lends to the culture here in the city, you know, that creepy Southern Gothic setting with that air that just feels so thick, and, you know, you have these rumors of ghosts about, and it's something that you really have to experience in person to get a good handle on. But to start this off, we have an airport here in Savannah. It just recently got bigger, but while they were making the airport bigger, the airport purchased the land around them, of course, and then realized that there was an old family gravesite in the land that they purchased. And typically, this apparently happens often with airports because, you know, they buy out old farmland and, you know, expand there. And typically, they'll just ask the living relatives to move the gravesites. And there's never really been a problem before. They just move the gravesites because most people don't really care what happens to the remains of their relatives from 200 years ago.
Yeah.
Everybody goes about their day and their business here. But the Dotsons decided, no, their family is going to stay there in their graves for all eternity. So the Savannah Airport, what they could have done is just, you know, pave over it. They had every legal right to just pave over it and forget it exists, but instead they decided to pay a little bit of tribute to this couple that is buried in one of the runways, runway 10 specifically. of the Savannah Airport, and they had gravestones made specifically to lay flush with the rest of the runway there. So if you're flying into Savannah and you happen to land on runway 10, you can see these two rectangular white gravestones that are flush with the runway. You're not going to feel them bump when you go over them, but they're there. And they're just hanging out. So you're
That's so weird.
It's such a strange little story, but it's also, I find it really endearing that as you're flying into Savannah, you're kind of just straight up welcome into our ghost culture here by this couple that is forever in this runway at our airport. So that's very fitting for Savannah.
Weird. Okay, so this is one that I don't think exists outside of the Hauk family. but there's a place in Ashland or outside of Ashland called Dark Hollow Road.
Ooh, Dark Hollow Road.
Which is, of course, home to very, tons of monsters and creatures and ghouls.
Sure, yeah,
and,
with a name like that, it has to be.
Of course. And so when I was little, probably like 5 or something, my dad told me that if you say Dark Hollow Road 3 times, then the monsters from Dark Hollow Road get you at night.
All right, that's two. Don't say
So if you say DHR 3 times, they're going to get you. And I was, of course, a little brat. And so I was like saying it a ton of times. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to fight off monsters all night. I'm not going to get any sleep.
Right.
Which is that just something that you made up?
Where did this come from?
Well, the name of the road, it just lends itself to there's something down there, and it just kind of leads to your imagination. But this is an example of where a tall tale becomes a legend because that legend kind of took a life of its own. And I do remember one time that was around Halloween where we had been talking about Dark Hollow Road. You had set it off, and we knew the monsters were coming. But what you didn't expect to run into was one of the fellows that lived in the complex dressed in a costume as a monster. And you came around the corner face to face with one of your fellow classmates, and they're dressed up as a monster, and you lost it. Your brain snapped. And you thought, and so I think that's when the legend became real.
I remember the Dark Hollow Road myth, but I don't remember that incident. Yeah.
Okay, first of all, you both
so
said
scary.
It. You have both said it 3 times in this conversation. Oh, you're both getting totally attacked tonight. And I think I can hear Sierra's mom laughing in the background. This is even better.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's amazing that I'm still into spooky things, and I wasn't scared to death.
I my mistake was introducing you to scary movies in an early age, and I remember when you were just an infant, and you'd be in my lap, and I was watching not even the best Aliens movie, Aliens 3. I remember at one point the person was talking, and an alien reached down and grabbed him, and your body jerked in such horror, and I was thinking, man, this might be messing her up.
Is she forming memories yet? Uh-oh. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That was just part of the childhood, is like we're watching the horror show and have to lie to mom about it kind of thing.
Right.
Like we were watching Hellboy with Madison when she was too young to watch it.
And it's like being imprinted with horror.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no way we could have gotten out unscathed.
Well, mom would ask what we're watching, and we'd say, oh, we're watching PBS, which stood for Pretty Bad Show.
Will you tell me about Bat Squatch? Because that's one that I don't know how I don't know about it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm dying to know, too.
Well, Bat Squatch was a legend when I was a kid, in 17, 18. In Central Oregon, we have a lot of, in the high desert, there's all sorts of odd creatures, I guess. And one was this creature that kind of would be like a Bigfoot, but it had wings and maybe a skull head with glowy red eyes.
It's like Bigfoot and Mothman had a baby.
Right.
What?
And so in east side of Bend, I had the friends that live out there and made a lot of trips back and forth to their house. But I never saw anything. I mean, I saw some weird things out there, but not anything that weird. But I do remember one night when one of our friends who lives out there, she came to the house and she was completely panicked because she had seen the bat squatch, and she described it as large, you know, like a bear-shaped creature. And as I said, it had like maybe like a cow skull-like head and glowy red eyes in the headlight and big bat wings. And it was on the side of the road, you know, as she drove by.
Wow.
And she panicked. We went out to look for it, never found it.
Jesus.
It was real for her. Yeah.
Oh, there are pictures.
Yeah.
People have seen?
There's an entry on Cryptid Wiki.
Well, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Here. There you
good.
Go.
That means it's legit.
It literally looks exactly says this how is I possibly a look. Misunderstood sighting of Mothman.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we just thought it was like a chupacabra, but I guess this doesn't have wings, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Mothman is supposed to show up at places right before a big disaster. Mm. So, like, when it was showing up in West Virginia, I think, it was right before a big bridge collapsed and a bunch of people fell off the bridge.
How are we not seeing him every day these days, you know? Like,
I know, right? You would think that he'd just be everywhere. He's probably very tired. Of course, there were Mothman sightings supposedly in Chicago about, like, months ago. So I guess he is kind of getting around, yeah. On the Boogie Monster podcast, the comedian Kyle Kinane does a Chicago Mothman character, which is very good. Central Oregon is also where we saw
that's
Bigfoot, right,
maybe,
right Dad?
Maybe I should get Vanessa in on this part of the conversation as we talk about Bigfoot, because that is something happened, and I can't explain it. It's a weird event, and a few years back, and it'd be, we were on our way from Ashland to Bend on Thanksgiving morning, early, really early. Mm-hmm. We were trying to get there.
Going to Grandma's house.
Traffic, going to Grandma's house, right. And traveling the road from around
97. And we were near Chemult.
That's it, Chemult.
We were driving near Chemult. And all of a sudden we saw, on the right side of the road, we saw this giant creature, is all I could describe it as. And it was like...
It was like a bear on two legs. It was big.
Yeah.
And the fur was not a solid color. It was like almost like a camouflage coat of motley different patches of fur. And it was kind of looked like it was trying to get into the garbage cans, or maybe it was kind of silhouetted against the first building as you get into Chemult coming south.
Restaurant.
The restaurant. And the weirdest thing was, as the creature turned and its eyes met us, its whole form, like, you couldn't focus on its features. It's like shifted and phased, like a weird camouflage. I was thinking of like Predator from that 80s movie. It was, and in that instance, I realized, well, that's how Bigfoot is. We never see him, is because he in the woods, you can't see him. He's completely camouflaged, and it just is that fact we saw him. Plus, there might be some way, you know, your brain has a hard time processing things like this. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, comprehending it. There's also something to the fact that we were all silent for like five minutes after we saw this.
Completely silent.
And I was maybe like 7 or so. Maddie was there, but she was like very small. I don't think she was caught like aware of it. We were all very, you know, silent for a couple minutes, and then we got out of that town, and then once we were out of the town, everyone's like, That was weird. You guys saw that, right? But we're definitely not going to turn back and go check it out. I'm just going to keep going.
No. Yes. And it's odd we didn't, because that seems like something we would have went back to look at, but it's like our brains wouldn't let us.
Nobody wanted to. There was no desire to see it again.
Yeah, whatever it was.
It was really bizarre.
It's not meant to be seen, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, he wants to be invisible, I can say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It'd be a she.
Or she, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So Bigfoot's real. That Squatch is real.
Right.
Definitely.
While Mom's there, can I have her talk about the UFO also? This is just turning into story hour. I feel sorry, Jackie. I'm sorry you prepared things, and I'm just like, this story.
I love it.
I'm not sure which one I'm at a
Do you remember when we were in Lithia Park? We were going for a walk to downtown.
I forget about them right after I see them.
Yeah, so we were going for a walk. Was Grace around at that point? I don't think so, because we were still at...
I can't remember.
Oh, really? We were still on High Street.
Oh, weird lights.
I just remember we were walking at the very entrance of Lithia Park. And all of a sudden, there were all these weird lights in the sky right above us. And just bizarre. And we were all like looking up in the sky going, does that even make any sense? What are we seeing? You remember that now?
Yes. I remember. They were
stuck around for a while.
Glowing lights. They were moving in odd patterns. Yeah, they were making 90-degree turns and darting and going back and forth and acting in a very playful manner. Above our heads, it was odd. There are different schools of thought as to what we were seeing, though.
The part that made it real for me is that it finally disappeared and didn't come back, and so we started to kind of turn around and go home, and we were walking through an alley behind the stores in downtown, and we look up and there's all these people on a balcony also looking up at the stars and like pointing and talking about it.
I
was like, oh, yes. It wasn't just us. Other people saw it, too.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I remember very distinctly it was by the duck pond. There's a big duck pond when you enter Lithia Park. And so there's, like, some streetlights, and there's, like, obviously bugs kind of flying around the streetlights or whatever. But Dad is looking up at the sky, and he's like, oh, hey, a shooting star. And then
directions.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's not a shooting star. And then the whole time you were like, oh, it's just a bird like catching the light or something. But then as we started to like see it longer,
I remember us arguing over what we were seeing.
All the things that it might have been didn't make sense.
Right. Well, certainly Lithia Park is well known for odd events, paranormal activity, ghost sightings, witchcraft. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising.
Oh, yeah, that's where the witches and the vampires congregate.
That's right.
What?
Yeah.
There's definitely witches in Ashland. I've heard that there's vampires.
I hear the vampires run the city council, but don't quote me on that.
They were friends of the city council.
Don't say that. Yeah.
There's a couple of ghosts in Lithia Park that show up in, like, the books of, you know, Oregon ghosts things.
Oh, like the hunchback ghost?
Yeah, there's the dog face boy who was supposedly this like kind of younger kid who is deformed and who would go around and get into people's like carriages.
What?
I've heard yeah, usually the stories, the couple of places I've seen it talked about is that it was like dating it back to a point where, you know, they were using horses and carriages and things like that. Mm. He would like go around and like steal stuff out of people's stuff and like, you know, was known for being this kind of mischievous character. And then he's seen around Lithia Park and the Shakespeare Festival of like trying to get into cars and things. And I don't know exactly what he's supposed to look like, but yeah, like a hunchback kind of ghost.
No.
In Lithia Park, as you walk further into it, there's like, of course, a big playground, and then there's a second duck pond, and then there's all these pathways and like hiking trails and things, and it gets really forested. And there's apparently a ghost that lives back there who is a logger, and you can hear him blowing into this big jug that he carries. And in Lithia Park, there's this like kind of semi-famous Lithia water, which is like very mineral heavy And of course, everybody thinks it has magical powers and things like that. But it's also just fun to make tourists drink it when they come and visit Ashland and watch them make a gross face because it doesn't taste good. But this guy, this logger guy, is back in those kinds of woods, and you hear him blowing into this, that like kind of low, whistly sound when you blow into a jug. And then you also smell the Lithia water because he's like, he's super into it.
It sounds like a supernatural playground.
Yeah, the
out
hunchback,
there.
The hunchback ghost is locally his name is Marion, and it's a little bit of a controversy because he's actually has not been sighted since the big flood back in '97. So we're wondering if that might have disturbed his haunt or something. I don't know.
Oh wow!
But yeah.
Oh okay.
No ghost. Yeah.
Swept him away.
There's also a reported spirit of a girl that was murdered in Lithia Park, and this ghost is responsible for the eerie fog that comes from the pond there. But that's supposed to be a thing too.
You and Mom also told me that the two duck ponds in Lithia Park are connected, and that there's a monster that lives between the two ponds and comes out and grabs college kids. And drags him into the pond. Yeah, that definitely sounds
that.
Like one that's real and isn't made up to scare their little kid.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. This is Gentry, and I grew up in Houston, Texas. Jackie's asked me to share an urban legend from my hometown. Now, Houston is a huge city, and it's the setting for hundreds of incredible, like, literally credible, as in unbelievable, stories. But the story that I want to share with y'all today isn't from Houston, it's about Houston. Specifically, how Houston became such an enormous and economically important city. And that story didn't happen in Houston, it happened in Galveston. Most of y'all won't have heard of Galveston, but to Texans, it's an important place. It's a smallish island off the Gulf Coast that's known as a local tourist attraction. When I was a child, my family and just about every other family in East Texas would make the drive over the bridge to Galveston a few times every summer to go swimming and to get some decent seafood. But at the end of the 19th century, Galveston wasn't just a small tourist attraction. It was the largest port city in the Gulf of Mexico. It was an economic powerhouse and saw more traffic every year than New Orleans, and definitely more than Houston. That all changed during the Galveston hurricane of 1900. This was before we gave people names to hurricanes, so they just named the storm after the place that was most impacted. And in this case, the impact was devastating. 12,000 people died during the hurricane. Compare that to Katrina's 1,800. It's the deadliest hurricane in American history, and understand that this one storm killed more people than every other hurricane in American history combined. And in that sandy, soaked soil of the post-storm island, there was nowhere to bury all those bodies. The holes would fill with water before they were finished being dug. Add to that the fact that the only railroad bridge connecting the island to the mainland was destroyed by the storm, so there was no way to move those thousands of bodies and no way to bury them. So the desperate survivors of Galveston just started putting the bodies out to sea. They pushed the corpses of their neighbors and loved ones out past the waves and called it good enough. And it was. Until the tide shifted and carried every one of those bodies back to shore. Now please, understand that this isn't the legend. This all happened. The legend, the part we would tell each other in the back seats of our parents' minivans every time we drove back from Galveston after dark, was what happened next. The legend is that after these literal waves of bodies came back to shore, they just gave up. They didn't move those bodies, and they didn't collect any more of the remaining thousands. You see, plans had already been made to raise the whole island, and this part also actually happened with certainty. Every building that was still standing was put up on stilts, and mud was pumped off the ocean floor until the whole island was 13 feet farther above sea level than it had been. And all those bodies that were never collected, they were just left where they lie. That's the legend. That's what still makes me want to look over my shoulder as I tell the story. Because they couldn't bury their dead, they buried their island. And still, to this day, all 41 square miles of the pleasant, sunny spot that we drive out to go swimming is a graveyard. Those that died in the 1900 storm are still there. Like, right there. Under the seawall, under the sidewalks, and under the shopping center. All of it. Of course, the Port of Galveston never recovered. Instead, a channel was dug from the Gulf of Mexico inland to the city of Houston. The Port of Houston boomed and brought great prosperity. And that prosperity attracted my family. And that's why I'm a Texan. Thank you for listening.
Jack, you want to hop in with, because I know you have a ton of ghost ones.
One that's really famous around Savannah is Little Gracie. I don't know if you guys have heard about her before. She was a little girl that was a innkeeper's daughter here in Savannah. The inn was supposedly one of the most fanciful hotels in the South at the time. So it was a big deal for for people to go to that particular hotel when they were in Savannah. And Little Gracie was the daughter that would run around while her dad was working. And apparently she would greet guests that came to the hotel. It was the Pulaski Hotel. She would apparently put on little skits for them, you know, do little songs and dances and just generally win over people that would visit the hotel or Pulaski Square in that general area. She was very well known. People just really liked her. She was just a very sweet little girl. She took ill in 1889 and died a couple days before Easter. At that time is when yellow fever was sweeping the area, so there was just no hope for her there. But her parents, understandably heartbroken, asked a sculptor, John Walls, to make a grave marker for her. John Walls has actually done a lot of sculptures in Bonaventure. Sierra, when you were here around Thanksgiving, did you guys make it out to Bonaventure?
We've been in there once. Because Tucker's family's on that side of the coast. So we go there for Thanksgiving. And we went on a historical tour of Savannah. And I asked them to just talk about the ghosts. Because that's all I cared about. And the lady was like, oh, I got you, girl. So we drove past it, but I haven't been into it.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And the sculptures in Bonaventure Cemetery are some of the most incredible sculptures literally in the world. The sculpture of Little Gracie is said to be an exact replica of her. There's a link there on our page if you want to click through to see the picture, but she is exactly life size. And when it was made, people around would say that it looked exactly like her. There's a lot of weird stories around that particular grave marker, though. People say that when the moon shines on the Little Gracie statue, you can see it crying.
Aww.
People have reported it being warm to the touch, even when it shouldn't be, when there's no sun out.
Mm-hmm.
People report seeing the little girl playing around the grave. One thing that really tends to tug at your emotions there is that after Gracie died, her father tried to work at another hotel in the area, and they basically, her parents just couldn't hold it together here without her. So they moved back to New England, and Gracie is left here in Savannah all alone. So they were, you know, they moved back to New England and they died there. They were buried there. So Gracie was buried in the family plot here in Bonaventure, but nobody else was. Gracie is such a famous statue there in Bonaventure that they actually had to put up a wrought iron fence around the entire gravesite, which is kind of a shame, but at the same time, understandable. But if you ever go...
Yeah, you want to preserve it.
Yeah, if you ever go by there, it is absolutely covered in little toys. People still bring Gracie just a bunch of little toys to play with and just to honor her and her contributions to our history here.
Aw, nice.
Which is very cute.
If I was making a movie about Savannah, I would have somebody be walking around and see this little girl and then take a couple steps further in the graveyard and see the statue and be like, oh my god, it was that girl. Yeah.
People report, they still, like, this is a very regular thing in Savannah. People report seeing Little Gracie in Johnson Square, where the Pulaski Hotel was. They report that they see a little girl in a white dress just walking around playing like any normal little girl and then suddenly disappear and just dissipate in the air.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's something that's so, it's so regular with people who have never heard the story of Little Gracie that it's very, very creepy. Mm-hmm. For it not to be real would be a stretch at this point.
Is mom still there?
She's nearby.
Will she talk about some of the ghosts that we've seen?
Oh, yeah. Do you like to talk about some of the ghosts that you've seen?
Because there's a couple.
Oh, ghost stories. I'd love to talk about ghost stories.
Yes.
So, what I'm thinking about happened. We lived in the railroad district in a house that was owned by someone that worked in the railroad at about the, what was it, 1904, I think?
Yep.
Something like that. And so we'd been living in this little house for a little while, and it was late at night. It was like 11 o'clock or so. We were getting ready to go to bed. And I had come out of the bathroom and was walking down this little hallway to our bedroom. And there was somebody right behind me, like right on my heels. And I thought it was Sierra's dad. And I said, hey, Jason, knock it off. That isn't funny. And I kept walking, thinking, okay, he's still following me. And I get to the bedroom and he's in bed. And I'm looking at him and I turn around and look behind me and there's nobody there. Yeah, that was a fun one.
Yeah, that house on Fifth Street definitely had some spirits. You could hear like sounds of children going up and down the stairs in the middle of the night. You get up to look and there's nobody there. Lots of weird experiences. But they usually happen like, you know, after 2 in the morning. So maybe it's just imagination.
Yeah, so the one that I'm thinking of was when we were moving out of the apartment on High Street and packing all day and getting boxes out of the house. And it was like just about summertime. And so we had the door and everything, you know, the door open and all that going in and out. And Maddie was still pretty small. So she was in her like playpen. And Mama and I sit down on the couch to take a break in the living room with the front door open. And we're just, you know, hanging out. And all of a sudden, Madison is, like, looking at a very specific spot in the room and just starts belly laughing and laughing and laughing and, like she's clicked this. And then she'll, like, stop for a second to listen and then, like, start laughing and laughing again. And she did that for, like, a couple of minutes. And then the front door closed by itself, which, I mean, it was open, but there wasn't, like, a ton of wind or anything like that. It was a pretty still day, and it had been, you know, open the whole day without a problem. And then, you know, Maddie's, like, having this interaction, and then it ends, and the door closes.
Yeah, that's not creepy at all.
I mean, luckily she wasn't, like, screaming or scared. Right. She was, like, happy.
We were also lucky enough to get an urban legend from Gentry's beautiful wife, Rita, for our collection. Here's her story.
I grew up in Eagle Pass, Texas, which is on the border of Texas, right by the Rio Grande River. And my abuela's house was about a mile or so from the river. And one of the stories that we used to hear as kids whenever we would get in trouble was the story of La Llorona. And this is a story that parents and grandparents tell their kids to kind of keep them in line. And the story basically has a woman who has children. And there's a couple variations on this part, but basically in one variation, she falls in love with a man, and the man makes her choose between him and her children. She chooses him, and she drowns her children in the river. Another slightly different version of the story says that she was married to to the father of her children, madly in love with him. She finds out that he was cheating on her, and in her anger, she takes her children and drowns them in the river. Obviously, this doesn't work out for her. Depending on the version of the story, whether it's revenge or she's trying to win the love of the man, she somehow thinks that this is going to fix their relationship, and obviously it doesn't work out that way. So when she's ultimately rejected, in her sorrow, she goes to the river and she drowns herself. Of course, she comes back as a ghost. So this is the part where kids get instilled with fear, because if you are misbehaving, then the story says that La Llorona, the woman, is searching for her children and she's crying out for them. And so if you are a misbehaving child, she will come and find you and she will take you as if you were her child, and then she will drown you in the river. And that will be the price that you pay for being a bad little boy or girl. So that's the gist of La Llorona and how parents instill fear in their children to get them to behave.
Do you have a ghost or something you want to talk about?
I do. I'm going to skip over to Asheville.
Oh, yay.
Okay, so one story, the Pink Lady, I kind of want to save until your dad gets back because it's...
Okay,
it's good. It kind of ties into that the ghost story you just told. But I used to work downtown in Asheville on Eagle Street. Eagle Street is like just left of the center of downtown there. It was right between two massive ghost hotspots. Our office there was like literally right between them. One of them was the site of a massacre in 1906.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll create a hot spot.
That'll do it. Apparently, a prisoner got loose from a chain gang and made his way down to Eagle Street and somehow got a hold of a gun and somehow managed to fire over 100 bullets back in 1906.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And killed.
Back when he had to, like, reload a bunch of times to make that happen.
He killed, apparently, at least two cops.
Jeez.
And at least three other people. They call it the 1906 Massacre or the Will Harris Massacre, but he started his rampage on Eagle Street and then moved northward up toward the center of town and was eventually taken down, but there were posses formed, and, I mean, there are ghost tours still going on there. Right now there's a bar called Barley's Tap Room in that spot, and I remember we used to go drinking there back in the old college days, and... It's the kind of place where you hear stories about billiard balls just moving on their own. And so if you're like there drinking with your friends, playing pool, you could be like, oh, I missed that because of the ghost. Like I should get a free shot. Like that wasn't me. So that's a fun little thing there. On the other side of that, like directly equidistant from the office that I used to work in, on the other side was the gallows. When Asheville had gallows.
The literal gallows?
The literal gallows.
It's like, oh, is that another bar? Yeah. No.
And it's actually right behind the Buncombe County Jail. It like literally it's in the parking lot of where the jail is now. And there are a lot of stories of inmates in the jail hearing things clang against bars when there's nobody walking up and down the hall, you know, random things moving in cells. And there have been a few instances of inmates just straight up freaking out over apparent apparitions that nobody else saw. So that's always fun. And actually, I just remembered curving around the other side. Like I'm like doing a virtual tour in my head here. We used to walk around and talk about the ghosts a lot in Asheville. Just up the street a little bit, there was a huge banking district. And when the Great Depression hit, it was one of those places that was absolutely known for bankers throwing themselves out the window. Like, there's one.
Oh, Jesus.
I know. There's one particular building where apparently several bankers just straight up threw themselves out the window when the Great Depression hit. And the building itself, I think it's the Jackson Building is what it was called, has these wonderfully creepy gargoyles up top. And it's a real treat to walk by there with the stories in mind and check out that cool 1920s Art Deco style, mm-hmm. and the gargoyles and all that.
It in my
yeah,
head.
It's wonderful. It's quite the scene.
Nice.
Another thing I want to mention about Asheville is Church Street. This is kind of a weird little tidbit, but Church Street is literally just a street downtown with a shitload of churches, and there are like little. Yeah, it's there's seriously like half a dozen churches on this one street.
Houses,
I know,
street.
Right? But they all have these like really old cemeteries surrounding each church for their own denomination and all that, and these churches are honestly gorgeous. This is the street that's there is an old cobblestone street. Supposedly, when they went to put down the street, the actual street that you can drive on, they straight up bulldozed through grave sites. Like, straight up ran a bulldozer through these existing graves to put down the street. So there is a lot of, I mean, you can imagine, there's a lot of disturbed ghosts chilling there, just very angry about what happened there.
Yeah,
to the point that how I learned about this was I may have been drinking and wandered around downtown and started following a ghost tour.
I belong here.
It's like, that's interesting.
Don't mind
what
me.
What are they talking about? That sounds cool. So... So they get to Church Street. The lady leading the ghost tour tells that story about how they just straight up bulldozed through all of these grave sites. And then she says, you guys take your time and, you know, feel free to take pictures and stroll through here. I'm going to meet you on the other side. And straight up sprints down the street. She absolutely refused.
She refused
to spend time on that street because she was terrified of it.
I thought when she said, I'll see you on the other side, she evaporated. She was a ghost the
whole
time.
That would have been even cooler. But no, this woman who straight up gives ghost tours for a living was terrified of this particular street. It's, yeah.
That means it's legit scary. Oof. Hi, Dad.
Hello.
Can you hear better now?
I hear you, yes.
Yay! Jackie, do you want to tell your pink lady one now? Mm-hmm. Nice. That's so scary. That nice pink lady.
Do you want to say another ghost story? Yeah, I think so.
Sure.
Yeah, I think we got a good connection. I know she's got a good one here.
Yeah.
Okay. So, this happened in the same house in the Lord District in Ashland. And it was shortly after my dad passed away. It was maybe 2 or 3 days after. And I was standing in the kitchen washing dishes. And as I'm standing there, out of the corner of my eye, I watch as a soda can flies off the counter and goes across the room.
Oh, no.
And there's nobody else in the kitchen with me.
Oh, wow. That's scary. I remember there was a time that happened also at the place on Harrison Street. I think we were all watching TV in your guys' room, and there was a, like, snack bowl or something that we sat down on the, stand that the TV was on, and, you know, everyone's just watching TV, and then right, you know, on the corner where this bowl is, it just, like, flies off, and nobody was moving, but everybody was looking right at it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Weird stuff.
We always had strange things happening, almost constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
You guys have something attached to you.
Never anything super scary or menacing, though.
Uh-huh. I've listened to enough ghost stories to know that this is how it starts.
Like, if it was gonna be bad, it would be bad by now, right?
Uh-huh. They're just waiting. They're just waiting until you least suspect it.
Sure. Of course. Well, my folks met it at the college there in Ashland. And that college, SOU, has a bunch of ghosts too, right?
It does.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah. SOU has, you know, it's an old campus and has a lot of history. So you can imagine it has a lot of ghosts. And I remember when I went to school there, I got to do a article for the paper on the ghosts of Southern Oregon University. And a couple of them that stood out, one is there's a legend of a hill that is in front of the main building, the main student union area. There was a hill where allegedly the members of the Ku Klux Klan would gather to have their events and to intimidate people, and that you could see the ghosts of the Klansmen lining up on the hill.
Oh, that would be terrifying.
The weird part is the hill doesn't exist anymore, so they're actually in the air where the hill used to be.
That's a horrible image.
Right. You can see where they were standing, where the hill used to be. Now that spot is where the road goes. So that was one. I did interview, I remember interviewing one of the security guards that works the night, and And he was really nervous about talking about his ghost experiences, mainly because he didn't like people making fun of him. But mm-hmm. He had lots of experiences that you would expect, you know, the weird sounds, lights going on and off, doors, and a lot of the basic haunting that you would expect at a, you know, a 100 or 200-year-old university.
There's also a lot of tunnels underneath the SOU, and I've been down in those tunnels with a friend once.
Oh, yeah, all the buildings are all connected underground by a series of tunnels and shafts.
Some you have to have keys to get through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was pretty fascinating down there.
Yeah.
Also supposedly haunted.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, totally.
Of course.
That's scary.
Yes, one building in particular, Churchill Hall, has got a lot of strange, it's just an old building, and so of course there's a lot of creaking and sounds of footsteps in the middle of the night.
Is that
that's about
one,
my experience there.
The big white one that's like, as you're going down the main street, is like kind of
that
the
big
first
house.
One,
yeah.
That really big yeah. one. I always got weird vibes from that one. Like, I always expected yeah. I'd see someone standing in the window or something when we mm-hmm. went by it.
Yeah. I don't have any specific stories about that one, but it definitely has some energy there.
Mm-hmm. What else? Yeah. What else do we got?
What is the Willetok Sea Monster?
Oh, the Willetok Sea Monster is a sea creature that, you know, kind of in the same line of Nessie and, that kind of sea creature, who's seen in the Puget Sound here in Seattle, and then also along the Washington coast and all the way up towards, like, Vancouver in Canada. And this is one that is seen, it's has a long history of showing up in the Native American cultures from the tribes around here. Like, they all thought it was a god that protects them and watched over them when they went out and hunted whales and things like that. But it's apparently been seen around Seattle before. I'm always keeping an eye out for it, just in case. Yeah, but it's like that kind of story where, like, the native people who were here would see it a lot more and, like, you know, had a good symbiotic relationship with it. But then, you know, as people start to move in and all that kind of stuff, it's seen less and less. And, you know, the people who were here first were like, just leave it alone, be nice to it, don't mess with it. And then I don't know if it's been seen all that recently. It was apparently created or born when there was a giant earthquake in the 1700s. It came out of the ocean.
Fascinating. I didn't know about that one.
Yeah. I mean, we're surrounded by water, so I figure there must be sea monsters out there somewhere.
Absolutely, yeah. I would be disappointed if there weren't.
I know, right?
Exactly.
There's also another spot here in Seattle called Steve's Weird House. And this is just some guy's house that I found it on Atlas Obscura, just looking at the things that are kind of around me. And it's this guy who just, like, has his house is just filled ceiling to floor with, like, weird oddities and toys. And there's some pictures of his house on Atlas Obscura, and it's intense. There's a lot of like Halloween decorations. He just seems like a very strange guy. Now I want to go and, like, become friends so that I can see the inside for real. Yeah.
Ask him to come on the show.
I know, right? There's, of course it's not open to the public because it's just his house, but you can go on a 360, like, virtual tour of the house.
Nice.
There's a link on this Atlas Obscura page, which we'll have in the show notes. But it says that his Unusual artifacts include circus sideshow exhibits, Victorian art, natural history, taxidermy, antique medical and quack instruments, funeral paraphernalia, and like thousands of books. And I just, I like knowing that there's this weird, like, intense museum just like among the neighborhoods here in Seattle with all of this stuff. And maybe someday it'll be, you know, open to the public or something like that. But
there's a Minotaur.
I know. There's so many treasures. So I've definitely wasted a couple hours just like looking at that virtual thing of like going through and like seeing all the things that you can spot. He seems like a character.
He has a 25-foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
He has a 25-foot tall Rapunzel tower.
Right.
We need to know Steve.
I know. Yeah, maybe that should be my mission for the podcast. Jackie, do you have another one from Savannah?
I do. Let's talk about Moon River Brewing. Moon River Brewing has actually been on a lot of ghost hunting shows. It's as it says, it's a brewing company now. It's a fun little restaurant with a few stories there. When Drew and I first moved to Savannah, actually when we were looking at houses, we checked out Moon River Brewing just on a whim. We had no idea it was a haunt hotspot. We were actually looking at their wine cellar as a venue for our wedding. And it turns out this building is just like hella haunted. Like apparently it was turned into a hospital during the yellow fever that swept through the area. So there have been hundreds of deaths in this one particular spot. The wine bar downstairs, the cellar that we were looking at having our wedding reception at, is supposedly haunted by a very tricky ghost that the staff have named Toby. And apparently Toby is just kind of a jerk. So Toby apparently like messes with stuff in a very annoying trickster kind of way, and apparently he just drives people crazy. So for one, I'm glad we didn't have our wedding there.
Yeah, he would have totally messed it up.
Yeah. But also there are two upper levels to this building. There's the wine bar basement, there's the restaurant on the first floor, and then there's a second floor that you're not supposed to go up, but if you happen to have a cool staff member on your side, they might take you up there. So there have been a lot of reports of just guests at the restaurant who will see somebody, some woman, standing at the top of the stairs, staring down at them while they're eating, making it super weird for everybody. And it's another one of those things where it's a common description throughout everybody that's mentioned it. And it's one of those things where it doesn't really look like a ghost. People say, why is that woman looking at me? Like, can you get her to stop, please? And they're like, no, nobody can get her to stop. Or they'll describe somebody bumping into them and touching their face.
Ew.
Yeah. And then turn around and nobody's there. But if you go up to the second floor, if you take photographs, there's pretty much always a bunch of orbs in the photographs. There's a third floor that you can kind of go up the stairs there, but once you get up the stairs, the floor is so old, it's rotted out, you can't really go very far. We were lucky to have a server who brought us up there the first night that we went, and there is like a noticeable like 10 degree drop in temperature when you're going between the second and third floor. It's creepy and it's so weird. But it's awesome. It's definitely one of the most haunted feeling places I've ever been to. So yeah,
that's
go and wow. Get drunk with the ghosts over there at Moon River.
Well, I have one that I'm hoping my dad knows more about.
Okay.
The fact that Mount Shasta is apparently home to some aliens.
The Lemurians, I think.
Lemurians.
Lemurians? Okay. Lemurians? Yes, and they operate machinery deep in Mount Shasta. And if you, on a quiet night, if you listen really close and you're on the mountain, you can hear deep down, you can hear their machinery. But they are a space traveling species. They've got a base in Mount Shasta, and periodically they do take their spaceships out for cruises around.
Joyrides. Yep. Yeah.
Many and a lot of the idea that some of the folks that go to that metaphysical library are actually some of these Lemurians in human form.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And I love the idea of aliens going on ghost rides, or ghost rides, joy rides around the area.
Yeah. Maybe that's what we saw, some Lemurians going out.
It could be. I will say the strangest thing I've ever seen that I have no explanation for happened around the same area where we saw Bigfoot. And mm-hmm. It would have been while I was still going to school when I'd first met your mom, but you know, we're still going to school. And I was traveling from, and it was one of those where I was traveling from Ashland to Bend to check in with family. It was late at night, and oddly, it was the night of that people were calling it was a harmonic convergence, which is a term I had never heard of before and didn't give it much thought. But I remember we're driving home late at night. It was pitch black, but suddenly it was as if it was daylight. All of a sudden, it was suddenly the sun was out in the sky, and you could see this big ball of light above in the sky. It was like a flashbulb had gone off, and it was like dimming. But it just floated there, and it was as if it was daytime for a good 3 or 4 seconds. And
wow.
I don't know what caused it, but it was certainly happened.
What?
That's crazy.
Yes. Yes. A big, giant, like someone turned the light on and then turned it back off again. And apparently when I went to look up into these harmonic convergences, this is exactly one of the things that happened during these events, these weird flashes of light. So,
are there other things that happen during it that you know?
Well, it has to do with cosmic alignments, and so sounds and flashes and you know, weird. Most of the stuff's on a metaphysical light level, but as far as you know, physically, seeing would be the light, the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Odd things like that. Yeah, I can't explain that one. I mean, I guess it could have been a meteor. I don't know, burning up the atmosphere, but it was bright too.
That would have been really a bright. Big meteor.
Yeah, no, it was like someone turned the sun on and then turned it back off again. It was weird.
That's bizarre. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah. I could not explain it. What it was, other than it happened.
Well, the last thing that I want to talk about is a story that friend of the show, Ellie Vaughn, her mom wrote for us about her haunted house. But before we do that, is there anything else that we're forgetting?
I'm sure there's plenty, but this is definitely a good start.
I barely got into the Seattle stuff. There's a place here called the Smith Tower that apparently has a lot of ghosts. The way that it's built has a lot of like symbolism, and like it has a big pyramid at the top, and there's supposed to be like energy protecting it, and it survived like earthquakes and fires where all the buildings around it were destroyed, but it still stood. And there's a tour that you can take of the tower that has the history of it and some of the weird stuff that goes on there, which I wanted to do before we recorded this, but then it just didn't happen. So I'll have to go check that out and report back on it later.
Absolutely.
And there's also like a restaurant and a bar in there. And at the very top in the pyramid is a like an apartment that somebody lives in. which is like the coolest place to live ever.
That's awesome. That sounds very fun.
Yeah. Dad, did you have any last ones to talk about?
No, just that. I guess one that really would affect us locally, I guess, are our own personal family legends is that of guardian angels, and mm-hmm. and that's something that my grandmother, your great grandmother, who recently passed away, but has always been a serious believer. I mean, deep heart belief in the idea of angels, and but specifically guardian angels that are there to look after you and to advise you on a level that we're not always conscious of. And I remember she would have stories of experiences she would have growing up, and I guess that was just something that, for family legend, is something that I always take in a lot of heart into, and the idea that not only is there more to this life, but that our ancestors are looking after us, and that they're always with us, and I think as I grow older, I've kind of come to accept it, and that as I look back in my life, that maybe there has been something out there that has led me to where I am, because I sure have been lucky. That's all I can say.
No. I like that.
Yeah. That's
so
nice.
That's about all I have.
Nice. Well, I want to close out. This is a story that Elizabeth Vaughn sent me a while ago. I was asking if people had just ghost stories and things like that. And she wrote this out for me and said we could share it on the podcast whenever. And if you'll remember, Ellie Vaughn was on our makeup and like costuming episode. So this is her mom, and this is about the house that she grew up in. And this is a house that I've been in and stayed at, and I'm going to stay at in June when I go down to visit for Madison's graduation. The Oakdale Ghost. We moved into our house in Medford, Oregon, South Oakdale Historic District, on Halloween night in 1992. The night we moved in, our next-door neighbors invited our family and moving crew over for dinner. The gracious meal with our new neighbors included a telling of how the house we just moved into was haunted. Our arts and craft house was built in 1912, and the house next door built in 1924, both by architect Frank Clark. I heard multiple stories over 25 years from several members of the family next door, which are summarized below. Around 1950, a retired FBI agent named Ragsdale moved to South Oakdale from a haunted lighthouse on the Oregon coast. The lighthouse ghost came with him. When my neighbors subsequently bought the Oakdale house in 1970, Ragsdale told them that the house had a presence. It was a lighthouse keeper, an old man in a slicker-style raincoat, hat, boots, who had been a presence in the lighthouse. It had moved with him and taken up residence on Oakdale. My neighbors, the W's, bought the charming historic house nonetheless, nonplussed at the prospect of coexisting with a relocated ghost. They told us that numerous members of their family had seen it passing through the hallways. They always smelt it first, a dampy, musty smell like a dank basement, and felt a chill in its presence or afterwards in its wake. It stayed mostly upstairs and often at night while in the downstairs living room, the W's would hear footsteps overhead. It was a non-threatening poltergeist. It didn't engage people, but it constantly stopped mechanical clocks. The W's depended on electricity and battery-operated clocks. When they had their hardwood floors refinished, the W's removed the complex pendulums working in their large grandfather clock and laid them methodically across a bed in an unused upstairs guest room. 2 weeks later, when they reassembled the clock, a principal piece of the works was missing and never recovered. The colonial house on the other side of the W's home was owned by the M's. They knew about the W's ghost, and at one point in the early 1900s, argued and then stopped speaking to them because they claimed that the W's ghost had started coming over to their house, and they were not cool with that. The M's sold their house and moved away. Around that time, the W ceased noticing any visual or auditory ghost incidents. Did it move with the M's? That's funny. I like the idea that the ghost went next door to bother these people and realized that they didn't like it, so they stuck around with them.
That's wonderful.
That's great.
Nice.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Dad and Mom, for talking to me and telling us really the stories.
Fun. It was great to talk with you, Helks. You have some great stories.
So, thank you guys for telling us stories tonight, and felt like we were huddled around a campfire. And our next episode, I'm super excited about. We're going to have the very talented Shauna Gore, who is a very awesome comic book editor.
That'll be fun.
And she's been working in comics for a long time, and she edited creepy comics for Dark Horse, and she just started a new job that we're going to talk to her about. And I'm super excited to hear her horror favorite things. It'll be super great. She's awesome. The Sirens of Scream is a member of the Mega Nerd Media family. You can visit meganerdmedia.com for geek-related columns, reviews, interviews, and videos. And if you've been enjoying our happy little horror show, please remember to leave us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to us. This helps us grow our audience, and then we can keep making cool stuff. Just word of mouth helps a lot, too. And we love being guests on other people's podcasts, too. So if you have a podcast that you'd like us to sit in on or a suggestion for us, we'd love to hear it. And you can reach us and send us messages at sos@meganerdmedia.com or talk to us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram. And you can find all of our past episodes and show notes and all of our recommendation links and everything at sirensofscream.com. And you can find me online at Sierra Hauk. And Jackie, where can people find you?
I am Jackie the Robot on Twitter and Instagram.
Awesome. So join us next time for Shauna Gore.